Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data science, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Peter Jones. Peter is the head of data for the internal audit function within Legal & General. L&G is a large UK insurer investment manager, and Peter brings a new role to this podcast, so I'm sure we'll explore more about this new world of data and analytics within an internal audit function, whatever next. Peter also has an interestingly diverse career, which we will explore. He's led data and analytics teams in the private and public sectors, including a couple of regulators. And prior to joining Legal & General, he held a leadership role at University College London. So he has made some interesting career choices during his leadership journey. Plus, listeners, he's a very personable guy, so I'm delighted to have him as a guest on my podcast. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you for having me.
You are more than welcome. It's good to have you with us. And I should let our listeners know that we actually know each other through you being a client of a few of my services, which is actually a great background for this conversation, as I've seen firsthand your passion for this work and the good sense you have to share with others. So let's crack on with my first question. Peter, I know you've heard the podcast before, so you probably know that I ask my guests to start us off by sharing their career story, their backstory, if you like, so listeners know where they're coming from. And now I'll continue the same tradition. Could you tell us a bit about your background and how you got into the world of data and analytics?
Certainly, thank you. So I shall start off with what I regard as my point of difference, which is for a data analytics leader, I believe I'm somewhat unusual. I stopped doing mathematics after my mandatory GCSE. I was absolutely dead set on becoming a lawyer and did a series of humanities A-levels, English history and politics. So I've had a bit of a screeching U-turn career-wise. So in terms of my career, straight out of university, where I studied at the University of Sussex, did English literature, went to work for American Express, who are a local Brighton company, and as a temp while I worked out what I wanted to do with my life. And then I moved into the financial services sector. I worked for a reinsurance syndicate in London, looking at aviation insurance. Did that about a year. But my first sort of job of any substance is I moved across to the pensions regulator, who are a large but pleased to say Brighton-based government regulator who look after pensions, sort of formed in the wake of Robert Maxwell running off with the pension scheme. Yeah. And I worked there in an insight role. So that was about gathering data from the market and working out what our policy and strategy position should be on a number of pension-related topics. After a period there, I had a 1 year at the postal regulator. You'll spot a theme here with regulators and the letter.
Yes, indeed.
And I came back to the pensions regulator to work on the auto enrollment regime, which is all about sort of mobilizing inertia, really. If you put people in a pension, they're less likely to leave, whereas if you make them join, they're less likely to join. So that was another strategy sort of policy role. And then I moved, so this was back under the Labour government, I moved over to the Home Office to work at the Identity and Passport Service, as it was then, to work on the ID card programme, which David Cameron very quickly shut down on his election victory. It was the one thing he and Nick Clegg agreed upon. nonetheless, I stayed at the Home Office for a number of years. because there are a lot of things around identity that the government finds useful, and it's very costly. The government spends an inordinate amount of money identifying people. When you go to the post office, they need two forms of ID. Mm. Whenever you interact with any government, you've got to prove who you are. It's a big time sink and money sink. So I did a lot of work around how the whole nation might benefit from joining together what we know about people. So a lot of sort of identity database type work was really fascinating, and I had some run-ins with other security agencies across the piece. So that was really, really interesting. That's really where my passion for data sort of exploded. I would use data, but this was a time where I was having to really think about the art of the possible, creating large databases and warehouses and structures and joins. And so that was very formative for me. And then sort of to rattle through the rest, I took a really unusual career path. And I jumped over into women's fashion retail. I worked for New Look for a short while, which is not a commonly trodden path from the Home Office to New Look. But sort of between you and me, it's quite difficult to get promoted in the civil service, whereas I sort of thought I would follow data rather than my public service sort of path. Mm. So I was there for a year and a half or so working on analytics programs to do with optimization, stocking and logistics and what goes where in shops, and lots of sort of fascinating data-led questions. And then I moved across to the pharmaceutical regulator, my third regulator beginning with P, third and final, I should say. There again, it was around data warehousing and sort of building MI and dashboarding. And then I hopped across to Transport for London, so specifically the London Underground part of that. And that was a fantastic job. They were just getting into data warehousing, so I had to sort of build a warehouse incrementally using Agile as each sort of need arose. So that was really interesting and forever sort of tearing up what you'd done before and doing it differently. So that was really, really informative for some of my warehousing experience. And then, as you said in your intro, I went across to University College London, where I was the Director of Insight and was trying to help this sort of global top 10 university, academically outstanding, but probably had its academics spending a bit too much time dealing with the nuts and bolts, such as the admission of students, and wanted these things to be seamless and quick so that their academics could get on with being academic. So that was great in terms of working with high caliber people who had testing and difficult questions. So really enjoying all of those things. Eventually, I was promoted to the senior leadership team there. I was the planning director very briefly, because then I got a bit of a dream ticket job where Legal & General asked if I would join, and they happened to be located 10 minutes from my front door, whereas UCL was 2 hours away. So work-life balance became incredibly important to me.
Yeah,
and that is where I reside today. I am the sort of head of data for internal audit at Legal & General, a role that sort of created for me in order to help modernise internal audit function, and that's where we are.
Fabulous. Thank you for sharing that, Peter. Gosh, 10 minutes from your front door. We've had other guests on this podcast. It's come up a couple of times, actually, so it clearly is a theme among data and analytics leaders who've taken a career move in order to reduce commutes and for work-life balance and an opportunity closer to home. But I think you hold the record at 10 minutes from your front door. That is good going, my man.
6 minutes on a rainy day if I get a shift on. So, yeah, just beat that.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, let's explore a few things that came up. Let's not walk past the first thing you mentioned, your point of difference, I think you called it. We've heard from some other data leaders on this podcast who haven't got a maths or science degree background, a kind of different degree, but I think you might be the first who's not got a maths A level. So I'm interested to know, in the long view now, do you think that's helped or hindered your development as a data leader?
So that is a question, Paul. So initially, I think it was a hindrance because I was forever having to prove I was numerate.
Yes.
But once you've done a couple of jobs where you say, well, OK, I don't have the qualification, but I have clearly demonstrable experience of, you know, creating these colossal VLOOKUPs or whatever it was that was sort of technologically advanced at the time, it just became an irrelevant. It's sort of come back around in my later career because I now have to do work with actuaries more now that I'm back in insurance. And statistics are very important, and it's, you know, important to flex your statistical muscle sometimes. But because a career of experience has taught me about P-tests and statistical validity, it's all fine now. But I think there was a period where it raised eyebrows. It certainly came up in interviews, and we noticed you didn't list Mass A level. But to be quite honest, I think a flaw of our, unlike the French and their baccalaureate system, where you get to have a broader education at a higher level, to force a 16-year-old to decide their career path is quite a difficult thing to do. And as I said at the time, you know, big fan of Ally McBeal and watching legal dramas, and a lawyer's life yes. was for me. What I would say, though, is I think humanities are a bonus for anybody who wants to do analytics, because you, in terms of skills around selection of evidence and around critical thinking and asking questions, they are incredibly helpful skills. So in some ways harder to teach, or at least equally important to teach, as the mathematical principles. So I don't think it was a hindrance. I don't think of it as a hindrance, but it raised a few hurdles along the way, but I seem to have cleared them all.
Yeah, that makes good sense. I'm glad you raised about the humanities, actually, because I was listening to you, I was reflecting on some of the best analysts I've recruited and had working for me in the past actually came from an economics background. And I found that it wasn't just the numeracy of that, it was the critical thinking from the kind of humanities aspect of economics, if I'm not doing them a disservice. And I've seen good analysts, again, from an English background as well. I don't quite know how to decode what the secret sauce is, but there must be something about the critical thinking that's required in learning those subjects that creates people who, I think you're right, approach problems with the right kind of mindset, even if they then need to learn some statistic or another tips to use to explore them. Would you agree?
I would agree. And I would say, having managed teams of data people, I think back when I started out, we didn't have terms like data engineer, or we had business analysts, of course, but we didn't. But that meant something slightly different back then. You know, there are analysts who you would describe as keep them in the basement with a wet towel on their head so their brain didn't explode, you know, mathematically divine, but you wouldn't expose them to your sort of business customers because they lacked some of that sort of interpersonal soft skills. Mm. And then right through to BAs who are used to conversing with the business and then bringing it back to the ranch and doing technical. So there's a whole range of soft skill experience. And I think it's, yes, I actually find it hardest to find people with a blend of both when I'm recruiting. Yeah. It's quite good to find people who are technically excellent and quite good to find people with sort of business analyst experience, but it is that lovely ability to combine the two, which is so not rare. That's doing people a disservice, but it's less common than finding the extremes. In fact, this is reflected in, you know, approaches such as Dunnhumby, who have their power of two. So you team a person who understands the business with a data person, rather than try to find that person in the middle. You recognize the different skill set, you sort of work around that difference. But if you're able to do it in one person, that is a wonderful skill.
Yes, yeah, you know, the good point. Yes, no, reminded of Dunnhumby and guests like Alison Williams, who we've had on this podcast. Their approach to developing people and supporting people is definitely one to learn from. I'm actually reminded as well, it's a little bit cheeky, it goes back to quite an early guest on this podcast, Martin Squires, who's now at Pets at Home. He has a great provocative phrase when he's at conferences. He loves to say, you can train technical, but you can't beat out stupid, or at least HR don't let me. I think there is a lot about the mindset and the attitude that people approach is more important than them knowing all the technical pieces that they can pick up more easily sometimes than the skills to be able to critically think about a problem and communicate effectively.
Yes, I couldn't agree more, Paul. I think that's it is one of the most important things you find in people who want to go far. But I also think as a career, as a data person, you're forever under pressure to choose the great bifurcation. Are you going to specialise or become a generalist? And in fact, it's a false dichotomy. If you can continue to bridge both sides, you become increasingly valuable to organisations. So I would say refuse that false dichotomy is one of the bits of advice I would give.
Thank you, Peter. Now, that's useful to hear, because you're right, you do hear that dichotomy a lot. In fact, Martin's often on the side of the generalists and making the call for that. But I agree with you. I think it is probably a false dichotomy that there are shades of grey in what an organisation needs. Anyway, I'm going down some rabbit warrens. Let me come back to some things I definitely wanted to cover with you. So The Home Office work sounded interesting, always interesting when there were allusions to someone working in the government and having access to security databases. It sounds very 007 and exciting. But clearly, you did do work there that was integrating many different major databases, even if the project didn't quite roll out as originally planned. I imagine you probably learned quite a lot from that. A lot of leaders that I talked to on this podcast will look back to and praise the fact they had opportunity to get their hands dirty with what we might call some kind of data engineering type work. Do you still look back to that work on integrating those different databases as something that still helps you, that developed important knowledge in you?
Definitely. I think it was one of the roles where I felt I had real freedom to think creatively. So if I come back a step, I mean, very broadly, the problem statement was, how easy is it for the government to identify people in the UK so that they can interact with government? And what we sort of had was a situation where we said, well, about 80% of people have passports, another 80% have driving licenses, not the same 80%, pleasingly, so you end up with a bit more coverage there. And then citizens from outside of the EEA, as it was, or as in fact still is, also had to have identification documents with biographical and biometric data on them. So you could get fairly close to 90% of people in the UK, and it was EU citizens who were not in that bucket. They had those documents, but from other countries, so weren't necessarily our database. But you could get very close to coverage. And so if that's the data and technical part, how do you join those people up, which is sort of easy enough with some fuzzy matching, is that what do you do with it? And one of the things that was quickly realized was that, as well as huge benefits to government, there were massive benefits for the private sector, which hadn't necessarily been tapped. So again, an insurance example, as I worked in insurance a couple of times and am now, is insurance companies sort of have a challenge around bad debt because they pay out policies to people who have died, and those people, you know, they had the insurers known they were dead, they wouldn't have made the payment. But having paid it, you can't really ask for it back. There's a family in grief. It's, you know, as I said, it's bad debt. And we were able to do some very good work, which went ahead despite the scrapping of ID cards, around rapid sharing of the General Registry Office, the GRO's death data, in a far more timely way, so that those sorts of payments could be avoided. So there's huge potential. And that was where I had such a good time in that job, was getting to think about what else would we do if we... You know, if sharing data were no, if there were no barriers, which clearly there are, but if there were no barriers, what else could we do? What societal problems could we fix? So I really enjoyed that role. It was an ability to be very creative and ask awkward questions around data and what it could tell us.
Yeah, nice, Peter. And I love hearing the example that you're quickly into the thinking challenge for the data leader of what can we do with it and what's the practical application for the organization, or commercial opportunities with other organizations. I guess all too often I find data leaders who particularly have come up through the technical ranks are quick to be having a problem like that and think about, okay, so what's the architecture solution? You know, what am I going to do in cloud? Where could I be streaming stuff? And almost the later thought, or only at the beginning, is the use case, not all the way along thinking, how does this help? What's the business implication of this? It was nice hearing you talk almost predominantly about that, and the data was just the means with which you could realize your thoughts.
Yeah, and I find increasingly as a leader, that's how you have to speak. It's not that other leaders are not data savvy. Of course, people are increasingly data savvy, but it's easier to engage with a story than it's easier to engage with a data technical conversation. So while I will go and have that data technical conversation and we'll switch tone and switch the nomenclature that I choose and everything else. You know, when you have a challenge like, you know, another example from the Home Office was that McDonald's are the biggest employer of people who have temporary national insurance numbers, i.e. they've just come to the UK and one of the first jobs you can get is flipping burgers. And they had all kinds of challenges around how, you know, are we employing people we shouldn't be employing? How do we make sure we pay our tax? So it's far easier to engage with those challenges. Well, it's far more important to initially engage with those challenges and what are the problem statements. If you don't define your questions, your analysis won't be focused. So I find it's really key as a skill to focus on those challenges before you then move to the, okay, you want questions which are unconstrained by the data you hold. And yeah. then you have an exercise, you say, well, actually, which of these can we answer and help with? And it won't yeah. be all, but I think you're right to identify that, you know, that critical thinking element is really important to do as a pre-exercise before you get into anything architectural.
Yes. Good point, Peter. And nicely put in terms of thinking unconstrained by the data about what the need is, what the opportunity is. And then you come back to how you proxy the real world with data, which can be what you can do with what's available, or even spotting, prompting the need to search or create other data.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Moving on, I guess the other key thing that struck me listening again to your career story, Peter, was the number of different sectors you've worked in, everything from regulators and insurers to women's fashion, which you made a big thing about, clearly important in your life, and transport. Would you recommend such a varied experience? Has that helped you as an analytics leader to have applied yourself, if you like, to quite different domains?
It has undoubtedly helped. It has also hindered you. So on the hindrances, you will sometimes sit in an interview and the person will observe you've hopped around a bit. And it does create that sense that perhaps you've moved on before any ineptitude has caught up with you or whatever. But thankfully, I think there's a bit of a shift happening where, you know, that, you know, doing 25 years somewhere and getting the loyalty badge is a slightly outmoded way of thinking, and particularly in data where it's such a fast moving sector, that, you know, sideways movement and shifting around is the norm. I would say on the upside, though, because I focused on the negatives for too long there, hugely helpful to get people, organisation, all those regulators, you know, regulators are a bit of government where they have an important job to do, where the rubber hits the road on some issue. But, you know, they're not well funded. They're not at the cutting edge of policy making. And data all feels very difficult and challenging. And if you can go in there and say, look, I've dealt with this challenge before. The whole world has dealt with this challenge, actually, because regulators are often playing catch up. You know, this challenge is faced in all the other verticals and there are solutions. And by hiring me, I will just implement something tried and trusted and fix this for you. You suddenly become, you know, like the dream ticket. They just can't wait to offer you the job because they can see that you can solve their problems. So I think it's hugely beneficial to have worked in multiple verticals, because data challenges are the same in all the verticals. You know, the hardest bit of the job is finding it, getting hold of it and making it fit for purpose wherever you are. And so those skills apply. So it's really nice in a way. I'm not constrained by verticals as some people are by their jobs.
Yes. No, I agree with you wholeheartedly in what I've seen as well. I'm interested, I guess, a conjecture you could make from that is you've seen the benefits, you'd encourage it in your people. But I guess leaders are also, in these days of talent wars, always struggling to recruit good people and keep and develop people. When you're having talks with people who work for you, maybe not just now, but previously in previous teams you've led, Peter, do you kind of pass on some of your experience and say, look, it's helped me to move around. Don't just think of a career in insurance, you know, go and get some experience in another sector. Is that something you countenance, or are you going to tell me now to stop talking before you lose your team?
Well, so talent wars is a nice way of putting it. I mean, when you end up with good people, you don't want to lose them. But no. As the market is hot, you know, and you can't always just necessarily find more money or more responsibility or a promotion for people. You know, there are cost pressures and everything else.
Absolutely.
So a trick that I would advise is to say somebody, look, the barrier to your progression, maybe there's something you could do with some more experience in, maybe there is, but really sometimes it's a game of dead man's shoes and you need someone else to leave, in which case I would say take the move, go with my blessing. Take something that's going to help you develop in any areas you need to develop in. But also, you know, don't be a stranger. Let's stay in touch, because if those dead man's shoes become vacant, I will want to let you know about it. And maybe you'll have gone on to bigger and better things, and in which case that's terrific for you. But I would also say, don't be afraid. You know, I've had people say, oh, you know, the move, the grass wasn't green, it didn't really work out. Any prospect of coming back? And you can say, well, yes, absolutely. You know, I'd still love to have you. So I think, yes, it's almost like there's a market for data people. And if you maintain good connections with the ones you value, you can have that sort of, So for example, one of the differences I've mentioned, you know, the regulator is very slow moving. It's fashion retail, incredibly fast moving. One day I said, we could do a segmentation, but we'll need some Experian data. I think I had it 24 hours later, you know, cost done.
Wow.
So in the government, that would have taken me 3 months to do a procurement exercise.
Yes.
So I often say to people, go work somewhere where the data is fast moving. You will get so much more experience in the 12 months there than you would 12 months in government.
Yes.
And it will be worth its weight in gold. So I would encourage people to move around. Definitely.
Yeah. Good. No, good to hear. I still remember a leader I worked for in the past who had a great attitude of, would always encourage and support people to leave with his blessing, and saw it as almost the most important thing was to build a great reputation in the industry for being someone who's great to work with. He's not going to hold you tightly. He's going to be keen to encourage you to move on successfully with your career. And not only might you, and he did several times, welcome back people who'd gone away and came back to them, like you suggested, Peter, but referrals happened. You know, people talk and people build a reputation that they'll say, yeah, go and work for them, that my part of my career really benefited. I think we can think of losing people and not always necessarily think of sharing out to the wider data world advocates of ours who will get the message out that this is a good team to work for.
Yes, couldn't agree more. And people certainly do talk. These days, if you create a job and someone's close to getting it, they will talk to your team or people who've worked with you. You know, what are they like as a leader?
Yeah.
What are the promotion prospects there? You know, those are sensible questions. So if you have done well on those areas, it only helps you to attract and retain the talent you need.
Yes, absolutely, Peter. So let's link back into another thing you mentioned, the building and delivering a useful data warehouse. I my ears pricked up at that because I've had the battle scars, as I'm sure you have, of doing that. It's not easy. It's a hard endeavor, but very fulfilling to complete, because most data warehousing projects fail. So those who've succeeded have done a good job. I guess it's been a very difficult time doing that for many older data leaders like myself. But it's also a bit of an unfashionable topic these days. So I was interested to ask, what did you learn from it? And is that still relevant and helpful to you today?
I think I'm so thrilled that I ended up being sort of senior responsible customer for a data warehouse. It really focuses the mind on how to prioritize, and really focuses the mind on what do I really need?
Yeah.
So some of the things I learned, the role you're talking about was my role at London Underground in Transport for London.
Yes. Yeah.
You wouldn't believe the sheer number of things that are measured at Transport for London. There are safety measures, there are performance measures, there are measures of flows of people through different parts of stations. I mean, they don't lack for KPIs. And when your task is to sort of automate the reporting of the KPIs, one of the first questions, well, which of these PIs are actually got a K in front of them? What are the things that run this business? And that's hard, but possible. Translating that into, right, what does my warehouse need to look like? Again, hard but possible. But then you break it into implementation phases. So in the first 6 months, we can only bring 3 data sets in.
Yeah.
So which 3 give me most bang for my buck? Which 3 correlate to most of these KPIs I've now identified?
Yes.
There's a lot of thinking, you know, genuinely sitting in a room with people thinking and mapping data to measures you want to measure. And you know, it yields fruit, because if you get it right, you deliver value at each step of implementation, and that makes it that much easier to release the next batch of funding, and it becomes a virtuous cycle. But that, as I said, that's if you get it right. It is hugely challenging, and you have to manage people who are very clear about what they want, but it is niche, and you say, look, I'm just not going to get enough back from this, so you're not going to happen for 12 months, and that's hard. Difficult conversations, but it really forces you to as a data lead to think, what is my priority here? And it is that exercise, that sort of evidence-based decision-making methodology of what is the mapping of the data I have to the questions I have, and sort of only progressing where you've got a clear line of sight on all of those things. if you can stick to your sort of principles there, you can, well, I feel I had a great deal of success doing that. So very formative, very everywhere else I've been since, I've had to, you know, I've drummed evidence-based decision-making methodology into my teams because I think it's, I like being unconstrained in my questioning and what does this business need to know. But when you go through the exercise of, well, actually half of it, we don't have data of sufficient quality to do it, put it on hold or put it in the bucket, as you said, of let's start collecting some data.
Yeah.
You need to be able to tell that story. Otherwise, you'll have a leadership team saying, why are you focusing on that? That's only number four on our priority list. And you have to walk them through how one, two, and three aren't yet viable. So strategic priorities they may be, but viable they are not. And and you draw that sort of big Gantt chart in the sky, effectively. I know you want them, but I've had to put them on ice for this reason. I've not lost sight of your priorities. And that's where long listing is so powerful. You can, if you show someone you've heard them, it's down there as a requirement, but you're just not going to do it for a reason.
Yeah,
that is so much easier in terms of stakeholder management than them constantly nagging. You know, you've forgotten about my needs. And, you can point to a picture and say, I absolutely haven't. That's crucial to giving you the time you need.
Yes, completely agree. And I'm really glad you took it that way, Peter, actually, that your lessons from this, because that does, even though we started thinking about data warehousing, I guess what you've expressed back, the developing of that skill in prioritization and that skill in managing the expectations of senior stakeholders, almost every single analytics and data science leader that I work with or I talk with even expresses the challenge of doing that, how they can effectively prioritize all the demand from their organization, still sustain the buy-in and support from a senior leadership, but manage their expectations and the buckets and force them to make prioritization calls. So I think you're right. I think mastering that whole area is a key skill for leaders like yourself. So I'm glad that helped. You're the only leader I've had on this podcast from an internal audit function. Let's go there, because we kind of mentioned at the beginning we might explore this. And I guess many might not consider that as a career route for analytics, let alone data or data science. What's happening? Is the world of internal audit getting a lot sexier? Is it changing in terms of what it needs?
Oh, I wish you hadn't said sexier. Right? I was incredibly sceptical about joining an audit function. I have been on the receiving end of external audits. I found them to be blunt and abrasive and unpleasant, and the thought of being, quote, an auditor, unquote, was rather unpalatable.
Yeah.
It's not what it used to be. I think audit got the bug for data a few years ago, particularly in the banks. I mean, let's just do a quick backstory. The banks are highly regulated and are obliged by the regulators to look at tens of hundreds of controls every month and report back to the regulator that they're sound. You know, are your monthly ledgers adding up correctly? Are your, you know, authorizations being done by a person one grade senior to the person who raised the transaction? And the banks have had to automate vast swathes of this testing because you need an army to do it otherwise.
Yeah.
And in so doing, they have sort of cottoned on to the benefits of, you know, or rather the need, an audit function in order to check that all these automations work has had to become data savvy. And what we're now seeing is a sort of shift in audit. So audit used to turn up and, you know, choose a high risk area, of course, but go in, take a sample and extrapolate whether things were working. Whereas the changes in data science mean you can turn up and look at 100% of the data and give more coverage, more assurance that things are working well. So audit has almost become a sort of analytics hit squad in that we turn up, we ingest huge amounts of data, test it all, and then we throw it away. And that's one of the things I found most challenging about audit is I don't have a big warehouse anymore. Audit is obliged to throw the data away when it's done. It doesn't need it in perpetuity.
So
there's a lot of, as I said, rapid ingestion, lots of corralling data at speed in order to answer the questions. And that's the thing. Audits are very clear on what questions they are going to tackle and what tests they're going to apply. So you get clarity on how you need to make the data shaped, and you go in and you do it, and you produce powerful statistical or visual findings that help with storytelling, and you're able to give a story back to the executive and the audit committee saying, these are the things that we perceive to be broken or need of attention. So audit, is it sexy? That might be a stretch. Is it? It's absolutely booming at the moment. I'm part of a panel for the Institute of Internal Auditors, a UK body. I'm part of their data analytics panel, and it is absolutely flying at the moment. We've got hundreds of member organisations. We're doing monthly events. I also have been a guest speaker for the European equivalent. The whole audit world has grasped that data is fundamental. It's the auditor of tomorrow must have the ability to interact with data, or they're not going to be able to audit. So there's just been an explosion of skills, training, technical training, and I'm dragging in non-audit, non-accountants into audit functions. Yeah. So the world of audit is changing at speed. It is a very exciting place to work right now. And there's massive demand. I mean, the market is hot for analytics people generally, but audit, I think one of the conversations I have most often with my peers is that it's just really, really, you can never find enough people. There's all, the whole industry is absorbing data professionals at speed.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that, Peter. This sounds like it's important to make sure we get the word out through the podcast then. So I guess I heard there the need for organisations for their internal audit work to be rigorously data-led and able to have that kind of analytical rigour to the amount of tests that need to be run, etc. I guess if I was sceptical, and I was someone who I'd know who had had in my dream to go and work for Facebook or something as a classic kind of data science type route, where's the interest? Is it a very prescribed kind of work, or is there room for interesting creative thinking and critical thinking and analytical skill and innovation in the way you answer the kind of questions that you talked about?
Yeah, good question, Paul. I'll answer it in several parts, if I may. If you're interested in data engineering, it is an absolutely terrific place to work because I work for Legal & General, an enormous FTSE 30, multinational financial services company.
Yeah.
Various divisions and verticals covering pensions and insurance, and house building and investments and everything else. So lots and lots of verticals under one banner.
Yes.
An internal audit looks at them all. So in terms of variety of work, and we have over 300 business critical applications.
Wow.
I've been here 2.5 years. I've looked at a smattering of them. There's so much more to look at. Data engineering wise, the challenges are terrific, and you're forever finding new data types, new systems, new ways of getting the data out. I mean, my data engineer is a very happy man. He likes the challenge. Right.
Good. That's good to hear.
So I'd then say, as a business analyst, if that's your sort of bent on data, application of data for business problems, it's very exciting as well, because although audit used to have this sampling approach, now that audits are able to look at big data and in fact to join data and look at data in a way which the business is not, because if you're a business function and your job is to process customer onboarding, then that's what you'll do, but you may not be aware of how that's sort of manifesting down the track in payments or complaints, anything else. It's so federated, whereas audit looks end to end across all the verticals. So the scope is terrific and the problems are unique. And so being insightful, which is what's valuable, sort of easy because there's no one else looking at the problems in this way. So it's very good for creative thinking and use of data and creative applications of data. And then there's all the visualization, and I get to use process mining tools, and my team are learning Python and R and statistical packages. And it's not one type of work over and over. There is an enormous amount of variety, and we sort of have a toolkit of offerings. So I think it's really good for people at that end as well. I think, though, however, if you're into data warehousing, it's not going to be your thing because we throw everything away. We have to. So if what you like is a beautifully manicured structured data environment, it's probably not for you. That's not to say there aren't other roles in big FTSE 30 financial companies that are, of course, we need that, but audit less so. So I would say it maps pretty well against most of the data and analytics careers, apart from the warehouses out there. Sorry, guys.
Okay, that makes good sense, Peter. Thank you, and I think that is worth people hearing. Thank you for sharing. It's worth people because I don't think there is a lot of knowledge out there as to the interesting analytical problems there can be to work on in internal audit, and I can see why you would get this rapid turnover of lots of different types of data and different problems to work on. I'm conscious of time though, so let me come to my closing question. I've begun more recently not to ask people what they've changed their mind about, which was an old stalwart closing question of mine for a while, but to use the closing question to focus a bit more on the portion of our audience who are earlier in their careers. So a number of people who listen to this podcast are analysts or early data scientists still learning their craft and wanting to know the way forward for them in their career, how they can develop. I wonder, what would your advice be now, looking back to those who are starting out, where should they focus on developing in order to go on and succeed in a data analytics career? Maybe even some who are listening and haven't got a Maths A level and thought that excluded them.
Yes, we still value you too, you guys. But what I would say is the old adage that I had as a youth going back was, you know, look at a job that was in a newspaper then, showing my age, but look at a job on the internet. Yeah. And that you fancy, and then see what they require and work backwards. And that was sort of good advice in terms of what do I need to develop, of course. But the other tip I would give is think about the interviewer's perspective. So, of course, do your homework about where you want to work and what it's like as an employer. But I think, what am I being hired for these days? Or what in my early career, what was I being hired for? They want somebody who can come in, understand the problem, understand the data, get hold of it, produce the analysis. But that old adage about, you know, communication is king. If you then cannot present your findings in a way that is actionable and persuasive and actually creates a change, then what was the point of you doing all the work? So yes, you know, be able to talk about your experience on packages, but I would think my advice is tell good stories, you know, express why something is a problem for a business, express what you've done to tackle it, but most importantly, express how you changed the world on the basis of your analysis, because that's where the gold is, really. That's where you prove your mettle. So telling stories is, I suppose, my synopsis for them.
Yes, absolutely. So good advice to those. And I would echo your thoughts, Peter. Develop those storytelling skills, develop your communication ability and how to put yourself in the mind of the need of the organisation and the people you're talking to. That's very sound advice. Peter, that's been great. Thanks for your time today. I knew you'd be a pleasure to chat with. Thank you for all you've shared.
Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it, Paul. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, also for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up. And each week, there's also fresh content on our blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, it just remains for me to say thanks, everyone, again for your time. Have a great week and perhaps reflect on the benefits of some of the critical thinking skills and the creative thinking skills that Peter's mentioned a number of times during your interview. How can you apply that? How can you hone and develop those thinking skills as well as your technical skills? Have a great week, everybody, and bye for now.